Speak with power, lead with presence, build your confidence. Meet Central Florida's charisma coach. Welcome to the Mary Gardner Show. Now, here's Mary.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Mary Gardner Show. Today, I have the honor of bringing you two very influential voices from two very different worlds. And what they each share is something that we desperately need more of today. Clarity, conviction, and the ability to move people with both heart and intelligence. We're going to talk about influence today, and we're going to talk about passion, and we're going to talk about how to persuade people in a world where everyone is shouting, but very few people are listening. But before I begin, I want to set the stage with two simple but powerful ideas. First of all, what is influence? It's not just about numbers, people. Influence is the ability to shift the thoughts, feelings, or actions of others without force, simply through who you are, how you show up, and how clearly you communicate your values. Influence doesn't have to be loud. It usually isn't. It isn't pushy. Influence is earned through consistency, character, and connection. Persuasion is the art of helping people see what they haven't seen before. It's guiding someone to a new understanding with respect, empathy, logic, and sometimes a little humor. Persuasion isn't about winning an argument. It's about opening a door and inviting someone to walk through it willingly. And today we have two remarkable guests who embody both influence and persuasion in a very unique way. Their insights will challenge you, inspire you, and give you hope that thoughtful, passionate communication still matters. Maybe now more than ever. Today's first guest is someone that I admire deeply, both as a communicator and as a human being. Now, I have coached thousands of speakers and influencers for decades. I've worked with high-profile leaders, I've promoted debates on college campuses, and I've seen thousands of voices trying to break through. And what I've always appreciated about our next amazing guest, who you probably know and love, Michael Knowles, is this. He brings truth with charm. He's playful, he's persuasive, he's unflappable, and he manages to deliver powerful ideas in a way that makes people lean in instead of shut down. Now, you might as well know that Michael is a grad of Yale University. He's a best-selling author, a cultural commentator, and as you know, he is one of the most influential voices at The Daily Wire and host of The Michael Knowles Show. But Michael, what I admire about you most is the way that you use humor and clear thinking to invite people to a deeper conversation about faith, freedom, and the future of our country, which is so important. Michael, welcome to the Mary Gardner Show. I am so thrilled to have you here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you. Very kind introduction. So it's great, great to be here.
Well, we're kind of in the same field. I mean, I've been behind the scenes for a long time, and you have just shot right up to the very top. And what I always... what I seem to really am gravitating to you out of a lot of the influencers that are out there just to listen to you, because you have an ability to keep conversations light, even when topics are really heavy, you've invited a lot of people that are opposite from you, and you're playful, like you're very charming, and yet you come with a zinger of facts. And as someone who's coached speakers for many years, I know that that is a really rare combination. So I want to begin with influence. Why do you think that influence matters, especially for people who are passionate about their values, and how does someone become the kind of communicator that people actually want to listen to, like you?
Well, it's all very kind. The reason that influence matters is because we're social creatures. So, you know, in the modern world, we like to think of, I don't know, in this very cynical way, we think that everyone's always conniving, cynical, trying to look out for number one, you know, one-up people. But I don't think you have to look at it that way, and I certainly don't look at it that way, even going back to classical antiquity, which is where we get a lot of our ideas, actually, about rhetoric and persuasion and oratory. You just recognize that we're social creatures. So human beings are naturally inclined to live in an ordered society. Mm. Aristotle calls us the political animal. You know, we live together. We don't generally live as hermits out there in the desert somewhere. It happens, but it's mm-hmm. the exception that proves the rule. And so if we're going to live together, then we need to communicate, and we need to persuade people of things. You know, we're we're like the animals in that we have bodies, but we're like the angels in that we have intellect. And so, unfortunately, a lot of our politics seems like people are just clubbing each other over the head, warring for influence.
Right.
But we don't have to. The other way that we can do that is we can speak to one another and we can persuade one another. And, that's the premise of self-government. It's really the premise of all civil societies. Mm. And it's a good thing. We don't need to back away from it. But there are two kinds of rhetoric and oratory. One is where you use language to trick people, as I was saying earlier, to get one up to, but the other way is where you use your language to convey the truth.
Mm.
And that's what we're really after, I think. And that's certainly the kind of oratory that's conducive to the common good.
Oh, I love that. So great. But so many times when you're talking to people, and especially in today's world, people are so emotional. And I know that the hotbed of emotion, the topics that are in today's world can people, if they have a person in their life that is of a certain persuasion, they may lean into that and just want to help their friends. And it gets so just personal. So how do you stay calm, and how do you recommend others to stay calm when somebody is highly emotional and you're fact-driven?
Well, you have to recognize that emotion is part of human life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you want to be in control of your emotions. You don't want to let your passions run away with you.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not just automatons. The AI hasn't taken over yet. So passion really does matter. My friend Ben Shapiro used to be fond of saying, facts don't care about
your
feelings.
Yeah, I love that.
Great
quote.
Line. Mm-hmm.
Great line.
We live in this hyper-emotional age where we're told that our subjective feelings ought to overcome objective reality.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that line is missing is the fact that politics almost exclusively cares about our feelings, because human beings are emotional creatures. So, just getting back to the old understanding of rhetoric and oratory, a speaker, when he begins, has to establish three things. The logos, the pathos, and the ethos.
Mm.
So the logos is the logical part of your speech. It's what you're talking about, what argument you're going to make.
Yeah.
And then the ethos is your credibility, your character.
Mm.
Why is it that I should be listening to you? Why do you have any authority to speak on this subject?
Yeah.
And then the third part is the pathos. That's where we get the word sympathy or empathy from.
Mm.
That's the feeling. That's the passion that appeals to that part of the soul. And you have to have that too. If you just get up there and give some dry lecture, even if you have credibility on it, people aren't going to care. You're gonna have to convince people why it matters to them. And so when you're talking to somebody and they're just becoming hysterical or histrionic, I think you have to acknowledge that, and you have to find ways to mollify them, calm them down a little bit, figure out exactly what it is that is so irritating them.
Yeah.
And then you have to speak to their feeling in a way that is going to push it maybe in the other direction to get them more excited and more inclined to agree with what you're trying to convince them of.
I love that. I know that stories are a good way to persuade people. Facts tell, stories sell. And so if you are talking to somebody and you're delivering the facts, do you take a moment with people and just say, okay, share with me? I love that word share, because it really it disarms people. It takes them kind of off their high horse and and it kind of drops them down into their heart. So is that how you do it? Because to me, it seems that you've got such a natural, playful, fun personality that you're able to topple them off of their, and disarm them in your way. How do you do that? Because I think that right now people are just so angry at each other and we want to start talking. And like you were saying before, we need to have those conversations where people are able to hear each other and to share. So what are your thoughts on how you do that?
Well, a little levity goes a long way. G.K. Chesterton famously observed that the angels can fly because they can take themselves lightly. So you want to be a serious person. You don't want to be frivolous. But likewise, you don't want to be self-serious. We don't need to be so heavy and angry and self-serious about everything. So a good example I think I would bring up in this is when a guy's trying to talk to a girl, sometimes on my show.
Okay.
People will write in. One day a week, I take questions from the audience.
Okay.
And a lot of times, guys will write in, and they say, Michael, look, I'm a young man. Maybe I'm a teenager, or I'm in my 20s, and I don't know how to talk to a girl. How do I do it? I get a little nervous. And this is obviously, probably for most people, this is the most important part of oratory and persuasion they'll ever have to deal with.
Yeah.
And so, I said, a lot of times, guys, especially if they're a little nervous, they lack confidence, they want to ease in, you know, they want to sort of take their romantic feelings as this very heavy, serious, sober cross. And I would say, maybe it's because I'm of Italian extraction, but I would do the opposite. I would say, if you like the girl, you know, you go up to her and you're totally over the top. You're really earnestly, where you say, listen, Sally, you know, you're beautiful. You're beautiful. I'm head over heels in love with you. We must go get a drink. I don't think I'll be able to sleep if we don't have a drink. I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, but you know, it's that's another way to do it where, rather than coming in such a heavy, serious, sober way, you come in, you can really surprise people from the other angle too. Now let's bring it to politics.
Love that.
If we're talking about very serious issues, whatever, war, migration, abortion, you know, any really heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Sometimes if you can just clobber people in a way that hits the angle lightly, that can arrest people, that can surprise them, that can help them to see the issue from a different angle, which is, by the way, the only way that you're going to persuade them to abandon their previous views.
Wow.
You have to make them see the issue a little differently, as you alluded to earlier.
Wow, I love that. You're using so much strategy in your debate and also in your conversations. Do you prepare before you are talking to them? Do you go in and find out their history, their character, what they feel? I mean, is that how you're preparing for your debates and things?
Well, I find the most effective way to persuade people is to appear as if you're coming totally off the cuff, as if everything's spontaneous. And the most effective way to appear as though you're speaking spontaneously is to prepare for days. you need to have a lot of preparation time.
That
spontaneity
takes a lot more.
So I try to. I mean, sometimes scheduling exigencies will prevent that. But I try to know a little bit about my interlocutors, see where they're coming from, what kinds of arguments they're making.
Yeah.
You know, our late friend Charlie Kirk was famous for this. Yeah. In his early debates, really, and I think he would agree with this, he wasn't really good at it.
Right.
And something amazing about Charlie is he just got really, really good at everything that he tried. And he took the debate preparation very, very seriously.
I saw him improve so much over time. I agree. I watched him all the time. Well, Michael, you model such steadiness, and I think it gives the rest of us permission to stay grounded. So I love this idea of influence and talking it with you. We're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll be back with Michael Knowles of The Daily Wire and The Michael Knowles Show in just a few minutes after you've had a word from our fun sponsors.
Let's unlock the communicator and the leader that you always wanted to be. Welcome back to The Mary Gardner Show. Now let's get back into the studio. Here's Mary.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Mary Gardner Show. I am having the most fabulous conversation with someone you know and love, Michael Knowles of The Daily Wire and The Michael Knowles Show. And we have been talking influence. And Michael, I want to jump into another topic that I know that you are very fond of. And this is about, how do you bring faith into your business? And how do you actually talk about something that's very private and often very quiet, and we keep behind the scenes? You and I are both Catholic, but you've brought it into a public conversation with confidence and grace. Even this week, you know, we saw the president hold mass for the Immaculate Conception, and he's acknowledging faith more publicly. And so it's in the public forum. But how does a person actively live their faith in a way that strengthens their influence rather than shrinking it?
There was a beautiful little mosaic at a church that I used to go to in New York, and it was that I was away from the faith for about 10 years, and this church was an important site of my reversion. Mm. When you walked in, the little mosaic said, "The truth above all things." So it's fashionable now to think of religion and faith as a purely private matter, kind of like a preference between chocolate and vanilla ice cream. You have yours, I have mine, and who can really judge?
Yeah.
But I don't think that's true. I mean, I'm with St. Thomas Aquinas, who says that religion is a habit of virtue that inclines the will to give to God what he deserves. Mm. And so it's the sort of thing that we really can reason about, and that we must reason about, because it is not possible to engage in politics without recourse to the moral order, which is not possible without religion. Mm. It's not possible to, you know, get up in the morning and figure out what we're going to do if you don't have some recourse to religion. Mm. So we're naturally religious creatures. We long for food. We have hunger, and there's food for us. Mm-hmm. We long for drink, and there's water for us. We long for God, naturally. That's true of all human beings everywhere throughout all of history. And the good thing is there is God, and we can know something about him. You know, further, I would echo what the First Vatican Council says, which is that the existence of God can be known with certainty from the created world using human reason. There's a lot more to it. There's a lot more revelation.
Yeah.
But it's not just, you know, we throw up our hands and say we can't know. We really can know. And so all of that's to say that everything we've been talking about, rhetoric, persuasion, oratory, you know, to do that in the right way requires recourse to the truth. We're hoping, hopefully conveying true things. And so not only would I say, you know, can you bring religion and faith into that, but ultimately you have to. There's no alternative. You know, if we're going to try to persuade people of, I don't know, to vote for this candidate or that candidate, put a stoplight here or, you know, change the HOA rules, surely, ultimately, we're going to be persuading people about the ultimate things, you know, the really big question.
Yeah, that is the biggest question. And it's such a great place to ground your life and using the Bible and going to Mass daily. I went to daily Mass today. It was so beautiful. So if there are so many people now that are coming to faith, coming to Christ and having their own personal relationship, but what advice would you give someone who wants to integrate their faith with patriotism and values into their daily life without sounding preachy or confrontational? I think you do a great job at that.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I think the first thing to recognize is that there is not a categorical difference or a, you know, a difference that is unbridgeable between your religion and everything else in your life. It's all kind of the same thing because you're a human being. Just as there's no difference or there's not a, you know, a total separation between your body and your soul, you know, your body and your soul. You are your matter, but you're also your mind. Just as that's the case, because you're just a person, you're just you, you know, just as you don't want to live a double life, you can't be one person with your family and a totally different person at work. So too, you know, you can't totally divorce how you live your life in public from your your religion.
Yes.
And so you just put it in there and you just you be a little unapologetic. I would say if you feel that there's a real big difference between who you are on Sunday at Mass and who you are on Tuesday at work and how you treat your colleagues, then actually that's a problem for you, and you got to bridge those two people closer together.
Oh, I love that. That is so true. And there are so many people that resist wanting to get involved with church because they see the person at work or, you know, road rage. So it's true that we want to be grounded and to be able to behave in the way that reflects our Savior, basically. What do you tell people if they are an influencer and how to bring it in? Do they just start talking, I don't know, about going to church? I mean, what conversation do you think they should start with?
If someone, you're talking about a public influencer,
public
like a broadcaster?
Public influencer, broadcaster. I mean, I see on Fox, I see, you know, occasionally they'll mention Jesus, which is so, my mom and I will look at each other like, you've got to be kidding me. This is an exciting world where this has happened. But what do you see people doing in a good way that's not confrontational?
Well, I do see that. I see people much more explicitly speaking about faith. And of course, you know, St. Paul tells us this. He says, look, you can have everything in the world. You can have every single virtue. You can have the theological virtues of faith and hope. If you don't have love, you're nothing. You're a clanging gong. And so if you have a hard conversation, let's say, you know, you're sitting with your confused cousin and she thinks she's a transgender or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, what we have a false kind of love in our society, a niceness where we, you know, you affirm delusion, you let people continue, you know, unimpeded in harmful ideologies.
Right.
That's false. That's not helping anybody. And you're not even respecting the person because you're lying to them. You don't really believe it's true, but you're just lying to mollify
them.
And I would say, if you talk to your cousin, you say, hey, listen, Sally, I love you. I love you. You're great, you know. And but you got to know you're not a man. You are a woman.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to. Here's why I think you fell into this. And here's what if you speak that, if you really speak it in love, I'm not saying your cousin won't get angry with you every time. But you know, I think in the long run that will help them to see that you really do care for them.
Yeah.
You're really willing their good, and you do have their interests at heart.
I want to throw another little thing just right before you do that conversation, maybe to hear their story and hear about how they feel and where how it happened, and then be able to invite the conversation where it's kind of back and forth. I think people want to be seen and heard for who they are first and acknowledged, but not necessarily appreciated or that you're saying, yes, I agree, but just like, oh, okay, have you ever thought? So a transition, you know, I, as I have a lot of friends and family who are, you know, have different backgrounds and live differently. And I don't always agree, but I agree with you wholeheartedly, Michael, that love is the way to bring a conversation about. I want to direct another way. There's so many conversations I want to have with you, and you've been so public about so many issues that I care about, but I know you've also been really public about education reform, and we're seeing an explosion of homeschooling and alternative education. Why I think this is so important is that if we are going to influence the next generation of patriotism, of faith, of believing in God, we've got to take back our education and not let the government control the verbiage and all the things they're learning. So what are your thoughts about it? I know there's been a study out by the Learning Council and by showing by 2030, traditional public schools are going to lose 16 million students, and nearly one out of every three American children are going to be educated outside traditional system. So it's going to be a huge cultural shift. So how do we get these kids prepared? And what are your thoughts?
You know what I call that 16 million? I call that a good start. This is very exciting news.
Okay.
Because I think a lot of this began during COVID. There are, to get back to our previous conversation, there are good signs that the decline in Christianity has leveled off. It might even, you know, Christianity might even be increasing. People are asking more serious questions again. You see this even reflected in podcasts and live streams. So that's all happening. But the real reason that public education is in a major trouble now is because of COVID. COVID sent the students home, and they had remote learning. Mm-hmm. So for the first time in many decades, the parents saw what these teachers were actually teaching the kids, and they were horrified by what they saw. Mm-hmm. Not just the extreme conservative Christians like me, but also people who were moderate, even people who were center-left or agnostic. They just saw that what was being forced down these kids' throats was totally insane and quite harmful. And so you saw a big spike in homeschooling, even non-religious homeschooling.
Yes.
That was a really good sign to break the system. Now, it's not enough.
Okay.
Homeschooling, I love, we participate in a homeschool co-op, and I know a lot of people have been doing that. Our kids are quite little still.
Yeah.
But it's not enough. We need more than homeschooling.
Okay.
You know, I think the libertarian approach is everyone just schools at home and that's all well and good.
Okay.
Okay, it's a little difficult for some people. And I would say the more conservative approach is, and frankly, even the more Catholic approach is, no, we need to take control back from the system.
Okay.
So we need to establish schools. We need to get resources behind those schools. We need to have not merely you know, the right individual approach to education. We need some political power behind education, because really the way that we let these lunatics take over the schools is we conceded them. You know, they came in with force, they took them over, and they indoctrinated generations of kids.
Absolutely.
I think this is a great opportunity for us to switch that trend line, and I think there's a lot of hope that it'll happen.
Where do you think parents should start? I mean, I think this conversation is really important if we want to shape a healthy America for the next generation. And people are already, they see that there's a problem. They don't want their kids indoctrinated. Where should a parent start?
Well, you know, I'm a big supporter of the Regina Chaley Academy. I'm, you know, some colleagues and friends of mine have supported that endeavor, classical Catholic homeschooling.
Yes.
But there are a number of options. That's really exciting. Parochial schools can be a little hit or miss, but you know, some of them are still very, very good, and they've seen a lot more interest, especially since COVID. There's always, you know, call your congressmen, call your representatives. That's important. We need to wield real political power, because our opponents have done so much better than we have. And I would get back to the basics, you know, recognizing that education is not just about reading, writing, and arithmetic. It's about character. I mean, that's always what it was. You were training students to know the truth, to love the truth, so that education can become a lifelong process. And you're training them in habits of discipline that will allow them to pursue the truth. So it's, you can't just educate for one subject or one specialty. Yeah. You have to educate the whole person, the whole student. And that begins long before high school. That begins before kindergarten, actually.
Oh, I so agree. And you were just talking about engage with your politicians. And in Florida, we have the school choice. So actually, homeschoolers are getting money for their children like they would in a private school. So we can, you know, encourage people to reach out and talk to their local politicians. You talked about character, and there's another school besides Regina Chaley, which I'm a huge fan of. Regina Chaley is a classical homeschool. It's Chesterton Academy, and those kids are just so polite and professional, and they're so amazing. So, Michael, I'm so sorry that time is coming out. I could just talk to you all day long. You are such an amazing person that influencers can look to for having rich and thoughtful conversation, and your voice definitely brings more clarity in a confusing world. And keep doing that mix of humor with conviction. We need more of you today. I'm grateful for all the work that you're doing, and thank you so much for spending some time with us today on The Mary Gardner Show. And as we go into a break, stay with us and introduce us to somebody who will enjoy and champion that. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure's all mine.
You're great.
You're not starting over. You're rising higher. Welcome back to The Mary Gardner Show. Here's Mary.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Mary Gardner Show. And as I've said before, my clients and my friends are fabulous. And today's next guest, Shepherd Clark, is no exception. Shepherd is a creative genius. He is passionate, fun, and one of the most extraordinary figures in the world of skating, ice skating, and art. Figure skating is often called the world's most artistic sport because it unites fine art, performance, design, and even music. And within a world that movement is known as the other miracle on ice, which celebrates beauty, resilience, and living in the miraculous. If you know Shepherd, that sounds just like him. Shepherd Clark stands at the center of that moment. He is a 9-time world champion figure, widely regarded as the world's greatest skating artist, and now is inspiring a global conversation about faith, creativity, unity, and a power of love in a world that needs healing. From a boy in the Deep South who struggled with figures to a man now seeking a historic 10th world title, his story is a testament to perseverance, God's grace, and a mother's unwavering love. Shepherd, welcome to the show. It's so good to see you here in the studio with me. Thank you for being with me today.
It's my pleasure,
honor.
Mary. It's always my pleasure. You're always so much fun. You're so inspiring to so many people.
Well, I just love people that are doing big things, which includes you. You've had such an extraordinary journey. I have loved getting to know you and hearing you. I would love to hear a little bit about your journey. What made you and this fabulous, I don't know if people could see you right now, but your jacket is just sparkly and fun, just like yourself. So tell me about your journey.
Thank you. We call it the jeweled journey, the other miracle on ice, because figure skating is dancing on a crystal, wearing jeweled costumes and competing for gold. There's kind of a jewel theme to my life, a lot of neat coincidence, and I give the glory to God. I must give the glory to God, the ultimate artist, the ultimate jeweler who adorns the heart with light. And I think that, you know, the very fact that I'm sitting here with you today, Mary, is the result of a series of miracles. And so when we say the other miracle on ice, you know, the world needs miracles.
Amen.
And ice is a crystal bridge uniting land masses. And from thousands of years ago, man was concentrated on these rivers, going in a common direction for survival on bone skates, one of the oldest forms of human-powered transportation.
Wow.
So metaphorically speaking, today, the fact that figure skating can evolve to inspire people as the world's most artistic sport, uniting fine, performing, decorative, and recording arts on a crystal stage is rather miraculous. And skaters tend to have an ability to bounce back and come back after adversity, just like last year with that horrible plane crash.
Recap real quick.
Yeah, the plane crash, about half the people on the plane were skating. Some of them were friends of mine.
And
many from the Skating Club of Boston. I represented that club for many years. And they had to host the World Figure Skating Championships in Boston just after that. And we had our most historic and best worlds in decades.
Wow.
So this is a landmark moment for our sport and history, and being an inspirational platform going into the Olympic Games in a few weeks, where I think the best and highest message that we can send is about loving one another and producing beauty together.
Wow, I love that. That is so powerful. And we need so much of that right now. For people that are just meeting you for the very first time, can you take us back on your earliest moment that you knew that figure skating and fancy skating, because I want to hear about the difference of those two things too, were part of your destiny? Because I always believe God has a purpose for us, and you obviously found it, and you've gotten to the very, very, very top in that world. So take us on that earliest moment where you were like, this is it.
On the jeweled journey with Mary Gardner. I love it. Well, skating is like jade. There are two types of jade in China. The jade of the millennia that's been carved for thousands of years, and the newer jade from Burma that's called jadeite. And they're both equally jade. So what I do currently is more like the historic jade of the millennia that goes back, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years. And basically, figures were the first Winter Olympic sport ever contested. And when I was a young child, I was terrible at figures. I could free skate. I could jump and spin. Mm. And I was very lyrical as a child. I loved music. Mm-hmm. But the discipline of tracing figures, these artworks, these designs, I was terrible at that.
Oh.
They thought I was dyslexic as a child because I just couldn't do them. So when I was about 12 years old, I left home to train with Scott Hamilton's coach in Denver.
Wow.
The top coach in the world at the time.
Yeah.
And my figures became very strong over the next several years. And the sport changed. It evolved, or maybe devolved in a sense, in that figures were dropped from the Olympic Games. So now you only have a long program and a short program.
Right, right.
But World Figure Sports Society out of Lake Placid, with the help of Dick Button and Dorothy Hamill and Janet Lynn and many icons, mm-hmm. came together in 2015 to preserve the historic figures history and the world professional artistic skating legacy. So because of that, I've had a second career. I had a 30-year career with the ISU and U.S. Figure Skating, and now I have a second career with World Figure Sports Society out of Lake Placid, New York.
Oh my gosh, that is so fascinating. A reinvention. That's so cool. Going back to what you were talking about as a figure skater, because I coached Peggy Fleming, and because I was coaching her on stage, and she's such a beautiful person.
Oh yeah.
And yet on stage she was perfect, and I had to explain to her, I was like, Peggy, we don't want you to be perfect, we want you to be fun and laugh and cry and everything. And how'd you become perfect? She said, well, when I was 8 years old I had to do these figure eights on the ice, and if I got out of the sign, you know, out of the little thing, I would get points taken off. So you, on the other side, that wasn't your strength, so that makes sense that you're more expressive and then you did learn through discipline, which obviously you became a champion.
Know it's interesting. I'm so glad you brought Peggy's name up, because she's such an icon and such a nice person, and her figures were excellent. She and I worked with the same coach, Carlo Fossi and Krista Fossi. Carlo is no longer with us, but Krista is still alive, and that was down in Colorado Springs. And Peggy Fleming was, in the late 60s, really part of an era coming into the 70s where skating evolved and changed. Mm. And it started to change, and the emphasis started to become on the free skating. Mm. And so I think that it's great that many of the icons got together in the world's winter sports capital in Lake Placid and created the World Figure Sports Society to preserve the history, which goes back centuries. Figures goes back centuries. It's very, very interesting. And what we have to trace is, you know, 1 to 2 millimeters wide.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really, it's intense. What you guys do. Growing up in Florida, it wasn't really a possibility for me.
Yeah.
I was in the pool, you know. All right. I have so many things I want to chat with you about. Briefly, I'd love to hear about the role of your mom in your life. And you describe the story as the version of the giving tree, which I love that story. Mm. Tell me about your mama.
Well, I have to say that without her help, without the help of God and the love of a mother, I wouldn't be here today. My mother was the one who got me into skating, and there's an award named after her, the Suzanne Shelley Clark Award, in the center of the Hall of Fame and Museum that World Figure Sport boasts in Lake Placid. And I can tell you with every fiber of my being that the highest and greatest achievement in my life, I have to maintain when I talk about this, is the fact that right after she passed away tragically in 2020, there was an award in her honor.
Wow.
And a story where I can share the background of my skating going from worst to first. My figures were so poor as a child, they used to stop my tests before the end and send me off the ice. That was a rule back in the day. Yeah, it was pretty bad. And that's why I left home to work with the top coach in the world, to work with Scott Hamilton's coach. And my figures, they became very strong. And I became known for having strong figures. And I used an art training technique on paper to draw them so that they would become better on the ice. So that's the whole connection with the art movement and what we're doing in figure skating to promote loving one another and producing beauty together and being the center of an art movement.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that personal moment. And I always love hearing stories about moms who drive. You know, they to have a son like you, I'm sure she was so proud. You talk about the Miracle on Ice concept a lot. And I'd love to for you to share about the movement, the other Miracle on Ice, and what is the heart of that message? And how do you see figure skating as a vehicle for unity, love, and healing the world?
I'm glad you asked, Mary. The other Miracle on Ice is about the potential of the present to choose to live in the miraculous.
Mm.
So this is the other Miracle on Ice is a story that we can tell, a story we can choose to tell today. You know, last year I began to realize something. In Lake Placid, there were two Olympics, 1932 and 1980.
Okay.
And in 1980, it was the Cold War when the hockey game was won.
And that was awesome.
Iconic, epic moment. But in 1932, people forget that there wouldn't be a Winter Olympics if it weren't for Sonia Henie as a teenage girl who was so famous as a teenage girl winning her second Olympic gold medal of three that people came just to see her. It made the Olympics in Lake Placid during the Great Depression economically viable.
Wow.
So they continued having Winter Olympic Games. There's a monument to Sonia Henie in the center of Lake Placid for that reason. And so I always wondered why there was this monument in the middle of Lake Placid dedicated to her. And that's what I was told. And so I think that, you know, after watching what happened last year with the plane crashes, the fires, the hurricanes, the political destabilization, people wondering where the world is going, and then I see the world championships. I see Kaori Sakamoto running up to Alyssa Liu at the end of the worlds in Boston and hugging her and jumping up and down for 30 seconds. I said, this is real punctuation to the fact that skating is a global family that travels the world together. We eat together. We laugh together. Mm. We play practical jokes on one another. We exhibit together. We're like this family that gets along. We love one another and we produce beauty together. And you know what, Mary? I think that is a good message.
It's a beautiful message, Shepherd. I would love to help you get that word out there because watching Olympics and watching skating, it's just so peaceful, and it's so, it's an art. And you teach that figure skating connects art, fine art, performing art, decorative art, and recording arts. And can you explain how skating is a true artistic discipline in less than a minute?
Figure skating unites fine performing, decorative, and recording art.
Yeah.
We dance on a crystal, we wear jeweled outfits, and we compete for gold. We're a unique culture that blends the Olympics, Hollywood, and the arts like nothing else. And it's such a joy coming from the deep South, from Atlanta, being a child and having the opportunity to participate in a magnificent family and global culture.
You've had such an amazing career, and it is so exciting. And give us just a quick pitch about the upcoming event that you're going to be in, and we're going to talk about it when we come back.
It's in Lake Placid, New York, in October. I'm working on the potential of winning a 10th title. There are people who are comparing what we're doing technically to what was done about a century ago by Ulrich Salchow and Sonia Henie. It's very similar technically. The competition is judged differently than other figure skating events, and it's for the world's greatest skating artists.
Wow, I hope that when you are on the stage, I know you, and I know you will be giving God the glory when you win your 10th world champion. You're already one of the most winningest champions in ice skating in the world. So, Shepherd, we're going to be chatting with you when you get back about some other exciting things about the world art movement. And again, this has been Shepherd Clark on The Mary Gardner Show, and we look forward to seeing you back in a few minutes after you get to hear from our amazing sponsors.
Sharpen your voice, refine your brand with The Mary Gardner Show. Let's get back into the studio. Here's Mary.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Mary Gardner Show. I am sitting here with the most amazing human being,
Shepherd Clark, and we are talking ice skating, figure skating, fancy skating. Shepherd, you've had such an amazing career, and you've shared a little bit about us before. And I know that we talked just briefly about a real tragedy that occurred last year in Washington, D.C. at the Potomac. And I know that a lot of those friends of yours were, you know, didn't make it. And I know that the world of ice skating has suffered a lot of different things, but also they are often the leaders in resilience. And why do you think that is? Give me kind of your thoughts on the whole community and
Mary,
what they're about.
What a great question. Thank you. Figure skating is very difficult. People who get involved in figure skating have to believe in something that they don't see or realize for many years. They've got to love something so much, and they've got to believe in something that they desire in their heart that they will not achieve, maybe never achieve, but they know that they're part of a special family. They know that they're part of a special culture, and that no matter what they achieve, they've accomplished something inspirational that onlookers are moved by. Mm-hmm. They're moved through fine performing, decorative, and recording art. And I think that once a skater reaches a certain level, they have respect, mutual respect for one another, and they're supportive of one another because the journey, what we call the jeweled journey, dancing on a crystal, wearing jeweled costumes, competing for gold, is a special journey, and we want to bring people along with us.
Amazing. I know that you probably know Nancy Kerrigan, and lot of us have seen so many things. And was it Scott Hamilton who had cancer? And,
yes.
It's just been, the resilience has been amazing, and they are inspiring people. And I think during the Olympics, one of the most favored thing to watch. And so I do think, is that why people do feel in that they're like a community and a family?
I think so. I think that these stories, like Scott overcoming his sickness since he was a child. And you see Nancy Kerrigan, who I was in the middle of all of that. I was training with her at the same rink in Cape Cod. And, you know, Nancy and Tanya and I are all very close friends. We're about the same age. Wow. I was in the middle of all of that. And I just remember Katya Gordieva losing her husband, training for Stars on Ice. And these people of my generation, Shishkova Naumov, were on that plane. They were world champions in 1994, and they were my generation. And so, you know, skating has a way of bouncing back. We've had two plane crashes. The entire world team died in 1961 in Belgium.
My goodness.
So there are a variety of other tragedies, but you have to bounce back. You've got to fall over and over and over again. People say you got to do something 5,000 times at least to learn it.
Oh, my.
So like learning a triple axel, learning a double axel, getting a single axel, there are these different stages. And I think these steps, you know, when I was a child, the Guinness Book of World Records said that a triple axel was impossible when I was a child. And I had to do them like every day for years.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. That is so cool. Well, now as you have reached the senior wisdom place, even though you are still competing, you're very involved with bringing the world art movement to the world. Share with us, what is it and what inspired you to create it?
When I was a child, I asked my father, I was about 9 years old. I said, "Dad, what is the greatest achievement for an artist?" The reason why I asked is because skating, we had the Olympic Games and the world title every year, and skating is an art form as well as a sport. And I always wondered, like, well, for artists, you know, when do they have their day in the sun? So my father said, you know, that's a good question, Shep. Maybe having something in the Louvre and being dead for hundreds of years. And I said, I don't like that. So, you know, from the time I was very young, I've endeavored to create a quantification mechanism for art talent, uniting, like, you know, relevance, originality, and mastery. Evaluating relevance, originality, and mastery. So I think that people can participate in art and know why they're drawn to something, why they love something, why they care about it, why they want to buy it, why they want to talk about it, show it to their friends.
Yeah.
One thing I like to say is that, you know, when skaters are on the ice, the reason why people watch skating is, or really anything, I think they want to feel what the performer is feeling.
Ah, I love that. That's so great. Yeah, that's amazing. And you talk just about some of the very famous people, and somebody you've speak so fondly of was Sonja Henie. And she was one of the first superstars. She was like the first influencer. And it's amazing that she was a Hollywood icon. Give me just a quick overview of her and why she's so important in the world of skating.
She's a fun topic. Statistically speaking, the fact that anyone ever lived her life should have been impossible. She was 11 years old at her first Olympic Games.
Oh my.
She also went from worst to first. She was last at the Olympics, and then the next three Olympics won the gold, then the gold, then the gold, 10 world titles in a row.
Oh,
and then right after that, she met with Daryl Zanuck at 20th Century, and he offered her a role in one of his movies in a skating scene. And she said, no, I want four movies all about me and ice skating and 10 times as much as you just offered me for each movie. And she ended up getting it.
Oh, my.
Then after her successful career in Hollywood's golden era, she founded an art museum with her husband, who was a shipping magnate.
Oh, wow. Okay. So she had such a phenomenal career, as you have. And I know that you're coming into your 10th World Figure Championship. And so skating historians are watching you really closely of your pursuit of the 10th World Figure title in 2026. And what does that goal mean to you, Shepard?
Well, first of all, I can't even believe I'm actually still skating. I mean, that's a miracle on ice in itself. But you know, each year, I think, is going to be my last. I had an official from Europe this year say, Shep, you are staying in another year. And I was like, really? Why? And this individual said to me that I should go for a 10th title because what we're doing currently in Lake Placid mirrors or reflects very much what was done in skating about 100 years ago.
Wow.
It's important to maintain the history of figures and the history of artistic free skating. Skaters have to have the freedom. We afford skaters the freedom to maximize their potential, to be them at their best.
Beautiful.
Without necessarily the confines of other judging systems. They're all good. What skaters are doing at the at the Olympic Games is staggering. Unbelievable, mind-blowing talent. You're going to see.
Wow.
And then what we do is we present the art of figure skating. And we try, our goal is for every moment to be a picture.
Oh my gosh, I know what you're doing is so beautifully done on the ice. And but getting this 10th title, what is the historical significance? You seem to know a history about your entire industry, but what's the historical significance of somebody reaching a 10th title?
I think that in skating's history, only two people have done that about a century ago. That was Ulrich Salchow and Sonja Henie. So this European skating official said to me, stay in, let's tell the story and link what we're doing to the history of skating and promote skating in a new way and inspire people to participate and know that they can for a lifetime. Sometimes people perceive gymnastics and figure skating, other sports, as being very age compressed. But part of the joy is knowing that you can participate in a way that people recognize and appreciate for decades, not just a few years.
That's just amazing that you've been at it this long. And I know that you are a person of deep faith, deep character, artistic. You've got so many interests, and it's been interesting to get to know you. And I love it. And one of the things you talk about is living in the miraculous. What does living in the miraculous look like for you today?
Absolutely, without question. It's about trusting God. It's about the name of the Most High. I believe that Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world. He's matchless, King of Kings. And I know that for a lot of reasons, I shouldn't be alive today. The fact that I'm sitting here talking to you, Mary, is a miracle in itself. I try to give thanks moment to moment to moment to moment and be thankful. I have a heart of praise and thanks moment to moment. There's a lot going on in the world where we can complain or view ourselves as the victim, but I think that's a mistake. I think the fact that if we are breathing and we are alive, we should be praising God and giving thanks and looking forward to the kingdom of heaven, which is entirely jeweled according to Revelation 21. I love reading the Bible because the jeweled kingdom of heaven is what awaits us, and I think that's some good news. We can be part of a royal family, and that's the jeweled journey. It's our trip to God's kingdom. And what could be better than that?
Oh, amen. Amen. That was beautiful. If you had one thing to say to the listeners to take away from your beautiful story today, especially those facing obstacles or feeling discouraged, what would you want to tell them?
For I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future. God knows us and loves us before we're in our mother's womb. I love Zechariah 9:16. And the Lord their God will save them on that day as a shepherd saves his flock. They will sparkle in his land like jewels in a crown.
Oh, that is so powerful. That is so powerful. How can people find you, Shepherd?
in today's world and check into the art movement.
Well, I think the World Figure Sport Society, worldfiguresport.org, is a good place to start. It's an organization in Lake Placid, New York, founded by the Kelly dynasty, Karen Kelly and Patrick Kelly, who are both Olympians, and from a family of Canadians and U.S. skaters in hockey, speed skating, and figure skating who've distinguished themselves over the last century. And I think that's a very good place to start. I'm sort of all over the place, and I'm recalibrating the world art movement to be a place where people can elevate lives and create community through the arts. And so figure skating I see as a central stage, like a nexus point, and that ice rinks can be nexus points to build relationships and elevate lives.
I love that. You have been so amazing to talk to today. We've hit on so many topics. Shepherd, thank you for being here with us today.
It's my great pleasure, Mary. My honor to be here with you. You are awesome, and I have so much fun when we're together.
We do. Well, friends, that was Shepherd Clark, a true original and an inspiration to anyone who's ever dared to dream, fall down, get back up, and keep going. I really appreciate you for joining us today on The Mary Gardner Show, and I am so glad that you spent this time with us. And I hope today you heard something that lifted your spirit, whether it was from Michael or from Shepherd, something that opened your heart and reminded you of the beauty that still exists in the world. And as we wrap up, I want you to hear one thing. I want you to know that you matter, that your dreams matter and your voice matters. And no matter where you are in life, you can always take one small step to change your life and elevate your future. Sometimes that step is courage, and sometimes it's faith. Sometimes it's simply choosing to believe that a better chapter is ahead, like in ice skating. I hope today inspired you to move on to the life that you were meant to live. Thank you so much. I want to remind you that you rock. You are an amazing human being. Thank you for being my friend, our friend. Go and be a friend to the world. And thank you so much for listening to The Mary Gardner Show. I look forward to seeing you next time. God bless.